First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry promised last year to take down all of Jacksonville's Confederate monuments. So why are some of them still standing? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, why calls have come back once again to get rid of monuments to the Confederacy in this city once and for all. Let us know your thoughts. It's 549-2937. Then later, how you can do your part to help the food insecure in our area this Hunger Action Month. That's later, but first this hour, a few dozen activists gathered in front of City Hall last night ahead of the City Council meeting to remind Mayor Lenny Curry of the promise he made more than a year ago to remove all monuments to the Confederacy around town, including a large monument to the women of the Confederacy in Springfield Park. Now, that monument in Springfield Park is still standing, even though it has been covered up by plastic. You'll recall the mayor vowed to bring down all monuments to the Confederacy more than a year ago after he ordered the removal of the Confederate soldier statue from what is now called James Weldon Johnson Park. This was all happening, let's recall, as the Republican National Convention was planning to come to town, although that didn't happen. A representative for the mayor's office last week said in an email to WJCT News that there is no update yet to share from the city on the removal of any remaining Confederate monuments around town. So the activists press on, and we welcome two of them this morning. Ben Frazier is with us of the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville. Hi, Ben.
Hello there. Thanks for having us this morning.
Good to have you. The other big leader in this effort is Wells Todd of the group Take 'em Down Jacks. Hi, Wells.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you both on the show. And give us a call, folks, as we discuss this. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJacks. And our Facebook page is open, too. Wells Todd, let's begin with you. You formed the group Take 'em Down Jacks a few years ago, specifically around this issue. A rally last night outside City Council chambers, because as I mentioned, there's still a very large monument to the Confederacy still up in Springfield. Tell us about your group's position and what you're saying to the city.
Well, first I'd like to say, Melissa, that Mayor Curry has failed Jacksonville. The City Council has failed Jacksonville. And the governor of Florida has failed Jacksonville. All of them have spoken, and what they are saying is keep the names and monuments in place. And their lack of action to remove these relics that celebrate white supremacy shows that they care more about appeasing white supremacists than correcting the lies and miseducation that these statues, names, and memorials stand for. What we are saying is we need to remove all symbols of hate and white supremacy from public spaces. If they want these statues to remain, then they need to put it on private property. We say get rid of them completely. They need to be removed completely. And we have a two-pronged approach to what we are talking about right now, and that is demonstrations and also putting pressure on the City Council, which has 7 African-American members on it, and putting pressure on the mayor, as you saw yesterday.
549-2937. Let me correct myself. That rally was actually Tuesday night. It's reached the point in this pandemic, Ben
right.
Frazier, where I don't even know what day it is. Ben Frazier, Northside Coalition of Jacks. You've also been quite vocal on this issue. We did reach out, we need to say, to the mayor's office from WJCT News, and they basically had no comment. What are they telling your organization?
They are totally ignoring us. We've actually followed traditional and conventional protocols in asking for a meeting with the mayor. We've explained in clear and concise terms what we're asking him to do. However, emails and calls to several of his assistants have been ignored. The mayor is shutting us down and shutting us out. He's continuing his bully politics, his old boy politics. Unfortunately, it's time for change and it's time for him to make the move, but he's not doing it.
And we need to note that the Historic Preservation Group in Springfield, SPAR, they are on your side. They would like this monument removed, although it is a historic monument. It used to be Confederate Park, by the way. It's been renamed Springfield Park. Wells Todd, I actually live near this monument. I drive by it pretty regularly. It's covered up in tarp, in like a big plastic tarp, but it's still there. Certainly removing this very large monument would be a big job. It would not be an easy fix, but certainly bigger monuments around the country have come down, like the big statue of Robert E. Lee, for example, in Virginia, that is so symbolic of the Confederacy. That's probably the most symbolic Confederate monument in the country. And that was very difficult to bring down, but it has come down. And so, you know, there may be logistical reasons why the city's dragging its feet on this. We just don't know, Wells, because we have not been able to get any information out of City Hall.
Right. And I happened to be in the area, I think it was last year, when they were steam cleaning that monument in Springfield Park. We as taxpayers pay for that. We pay for the cleaning of that thing and the maintenance of it. And it's a relic. It celebrates white supremacy, as I said earlier. And I would like to speak directly to the United Daughters of the Confederacy chapter that is here in Jacksonville, who has remained, they have remained silent on this matter. And they are responsible for the distortion of Southern history. The United Daughters of the Confederacy walked hand in hand with the KKK through their nightmarish terrorist period of 100 years of segregation in the South. And they need to come forward and apologize for what their ancestors did and their involvement in fostering the violence that took place against African Americans. When these statues went up, at each one of them, there were speeches that were given that celebrated the philosophy of white supremacy. And something else I want to say, all of a sudden this got put in the mayor's hands, and then the mayor shifted it off to a working committee. This was brought before the city council by then President Anna Brochet. This is a city council situation here. This is their problem. And we need to be checking them on this.
Well, let me ask about this. Ben, have you spoken with members of the city council about this?
Yes.
What are they saying?
As we have for the past 4 years. Listen, folks, this is a matter to be dealt with by all of the shareholders in this community, the public sector, the private sector. We have sent letters to Daniel Davis at the Chamber of Commerce, to Jeannie Miller at the Jacksonville Civic Council, to every member of the Jacksonville City Council, including President Sam Newby and Vice President Terrence Freeman. We're getting the look the other way routine, which is why we went down to City Hall and made the ruckus that we made, and we'll be back. Aggravation, that's what we are dealing with. We are aggravated. And our aggravation calls for agitation in order that a remedy may be found.
549-2937. Give us a call. Edward in Jax. Edward, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Go ahead.
So my comment would be, it's just if the statues, I understand taking down the statues and removing them from the public space. But if they're meant if the purpose for it is to actually educate what the Confederate statues were and why they were erected in the first place, I feel like they would be more important maybe placing them somewhere where education would be its purpose, and maybe not in a public space, but somewhere where an institution that has the ability to do that, if that makes sense.
All right, Edward, thank you for that. Wells Todd, throughout this whole era of monument removal all over the country, not just Jacksonville, there have been some who've said that. Why not put some of these monuments in a museum and contextualize them to educate people about racism, slavery, the Confederacy, and Jim Crow? What say you?
I think the problem here is that education should come from our schools, the institution of learning. In Germany, they still teach the horrors of what the Nazis did, what Hitler did. We don't even know about Reconstruction in this country is not taught in schools. The terror campaign against African Americans, the struggles and resistance against slavery. These statues being put in a museum with the same tagline that they have right now, that the Civil War was fought for states' rights, won't change anything. What people have to understand is they do not really know the history of their own country. So when people say you want to get rid of history, you want to know. What we want to do is correct history. And it looks like what's going to have to happen is that we're going to have to fill the streets of Jacksonville like we did last summer around police brutality before there's some movement here. My thing is right now is that we need thousands of people to come out like they have done in other states like New Orleans. And so this is what is going to take place because it's going to have to because these politicians, they don't move until the people move. And that is a situation that's been proven through history in this country.
I think also, well, that we must begin the education process on radio programs just like this. There's some people who really don't grasp why we want these monuments gone. Folks, this is not about brass, metal, or stone, or attempting to erase history or to attack Southern heritage. What we're fighting against is what these monuments represent. They represent racial hatred. They represent white supremacy. They represent man's inhumanity to man. We are not forced to pay for the maintenance of these monuments, which were designed to perpetuate keeping my people in chains. Taxpayer money should not be meant to maintain these on public property.
Can I ask you both, the Monument to the Women of the Confederacy is the focus right now. As I mentioned, it's a very large stone monument in Springfield Park. It is covered up with plastic, at least part of it. Are there any other monuments or memorials still on the list that you're asking City Hall to also remove? Are there any still left? Of course, the big one in the former Hemming Park of the Confederate soldier, now James Weldon Johnson Park, that's gone. But are there others besides the one in Springfield? Or is that the only one? Guys, can you hear me?
Do you know of one?
Certainly. There are identified by the special committee. There were 11 in total, and that is a list that should be reviewed. However, we are focusing on this particular monument because this is what the mayor said he would do. The mayor should stand by his word. In the words of Philip Baber, a local activist, a broken promise is a lie. Mayor Curry is living a lie. We are here today to call on him to stand by his word. We cannot allow him to back off when he said he would do this. We all heard him say it, and he should stand by his word.
Let's go back to last summer. The mayor did promise to take down all of the monuments. He did follow through on the one in James Weldon Johnson Park. This was at the height of Black Lives Matter protests that were happening in this city. And for more context, Wells Todd, at the same time, the mayor was lobbying to bring the Republican National Convention to Jacksonville. And he was anticipating a white hot spotlight on this city if it were to come here. Of course, it ended up not coming here due to a number of reasons, including the pandemic. So when we look at the mayor's words in that political context from last summer, what are your thoughts today?
My thoughts are the same as they were last summer. And that is that he should have followed through on what he said at that moment. He should have removed the statue in what is now Springfield Park. I want to say something about that statue because a lot of people, they don't understand the symbolic nature of having that woman and those children up in Springfield Park. One has to, black people understand this for the most part. When Reconstruction was overthrown, okay, what started to happen was lynchings had been happening throughout that period, but they really stepped up after that. And it was to take back power in the South, rich white people who lived in the South, the landowners. But what you have to understand is that one of the techniques they used, one of the propaganda tools, was that black men were going around and raping white women, okay? And many, many cases where black people were trying to vote, they would be lynched under the guise that they had said something to a white woman improperly or looked at a white woman or touched a white woman. That never happened. And so this statue is an affront to African Americans, especially African American men, who were lynched, who were hung from trees because they wanted to vote. And then they were charged with touching a woman. And it's the same excuse they used to burn down our communities. It was the same excuse they used to gun people down in Oklahoma. And so we are saying, remove this relic of white supremacy now. We have to get on with the job of re-educating people about the South, which they know nothing about. All right? And we need to move forward. We need to be teaching this history in our schools. I have been, and Ben has been, before the school board many times, explaining to them how they are creating white supremacists by not teaching the history of this nation. Not teaching the history.
Let me
of
jump
slavery.
In and say that not the sorry to cut you off. The teaching of critical race theory has been banned in the state of Florida at the statewide level. The kinds of things that both of you are talking about, providing context to today by examining these monuments through the lens you're discussing. Teachers aren't allowed to teach that in the state of Florida. Kendra in Mandarin. Hi, Kendra.
Good morning, Melissa.
Go ahead.
Well, I'd like to say, since your comment just a moment ago was that critical race theory has been disallowed in Florida schools, as a former educator, I have to say it is incumbent upon teachers to teach history and all subjects with accuracy. So I think discussing critical race theory is an important point here, and also bringing up the lost cause. History has already been rewritten. And I think to simply examine the idea critical theory in any topic, critical law theory, critical race theory, is simply the examination of our history. We can't just sweep it under the rug. Secondly, I'd like to say that when we put a monument, a statue, something in a public square, like in the middle of a public square, that is giving the impression that this was a celebratory event or this person should right. be revered. Right. And I think that's just very inappropriate. I love the idea of putting these in a Confederate museum. No one's trying to destroy the past. No one's trying to throw things in the garbage. I think they need to be simply relocated and contextualized. And thank you.
Thank you, Kendra. By the way, let me just point out, critical race theory wasn't being taught in our schools to begin with. Mainly, it's taught in law schools. Ben Frazier, critics of the move to ban critical race theory in Florida schools call it performative because it wasn't being taught to begin with. That said, what you're calling for is an accurate teaching of history. I just wanted to point that out. And what about her comment that when you have these monuments in public parks and public squares, that is a way of honoring. And so people all over the country calling for these removals are saying that these historical figures do not deserve a place of honor.
I think we've reached the point where we recognize that these people should not be honored. The question now before us is what are we going to do about it? We need people who are going to stand up. We need Dunn and Bradstreet, who moved here from New York, to stand up. We need National Fidelity to stand up. What we're talking about is the captains of industry, the big ballers and the shot callers, to let us know where we are on this. The big issue here is that there's a problem with racial relations in this town. The mayor doesn't get it. It's time for us to move forward with regard to racial reconciliation and to address our cares and concerns. This monument is one of them. Let's be honest and straightforward in our discussion. Let's sit down and talk. Come, let us reason together, we say to the mayor, and we say, that does sound reasonable, doesn't it?
Here's a tweet from a listener. The monument's made of metal, could be melted down and turned into tiny shovels. Attach a packet of seeds to the shovel and give them to children with an explanation of what it's all about. Beat your swords into plowshares. Thanks for that.
Sounds good to me. That's the word.
Lots of calls. Jim in Riverside. Hi, Jim. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. And I'd like to just remind Mayor Curry that the people have already stood up and said what they wanted ever since Lenny Curry pledged to take all the statues down. Since then, the school boards and the people have actually came to vote on the schools that were all named after Confederate generals, have voted to remove those names. So not only has he pledged to the public has stepped up and said, this is what we want. We want to remove the exaltation of the Confederacy from our public places. So I don't know what excuse there is for the council or the mayor to drag their feet on this. He has spoken and the voters have spoken on this issue.
Yeah, thanks for that. Wells, Todd, you know, it is curious to see that this monument is covered up in plastic. So it's sort of in limbo. And we don't know quite the reason why.
Well, I think, you know, when we started to demand the removal of these statues some 4 years ago, other people in Jacksonville responded in different ways. They responded in different ways. And one of the ways that they responded to, as they have in other states, was to graffitified, if that's a word, the monuments and statues to let people know that these things needed to be removed. And I think that that's what they're afraid of. There are people in the city that are not connected to us at all, but who raise their voices in that way. And I think they know that if they take the cover off of that thing, the same thing's going to happen that happened before. Because people are sick and tired of it. You know, like the gentleman just said, the people have spoken. But as we know, politicians run years behind what the people want, what the people believe.
Peter in Arlington, Peter in Arlington has been holding. Peter, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. First, as far as critical race theory, I don't even think they have the definition right, the one they're using for the statute. And it's got to be unconstitutional. It's just ridiculous that they're doing that. Now, as far as the monuments, you know, the Confederate monuments, maybe it's just better they go to the museum. I mean, instead of just leaving them there the way the mayor is, maybe he can convince private foundations to take them and, you know, do what they want with them, just get them off the city parks. Now, about the city parks, I've been walking through several parks this morning and, you know, that everyone enjoys, and the common areas are completely trashed. So obviously the city is struggling with money, it seems. So just get rid of those monuments, save the money, and clean up the parks that all of us enjoy. So that's a practical
We have the largest urban park system in the country, Peter, but we don't always have the best maintained. Ben Frazier, you know, this is something that both of you have been working on for years now. You'll continue to take this matter up with the city council. As you mentioned, both the president and the vice president are African American this year. That's really where this goes next, doesn't it?
Yes, but this is something not just in the hands of Black City Council people or the Black City Council president. There are 19 members of the council. They need to stand up. They need to speak out. The mayor needs to speak out. The business community in this town should stop turning its head and looking the other way. Our reputation and our image as a city is at stake. Folks, we cannot move forward with one foot stuck in the past and still fighting the Civil War and then trying to march into the sunlight of a new day with the other foot. We've got to make it a commitment and divorce ourselves from the racial hatred of the past. In the words of civil rights icon John Lewis, never be afraid to make some noise and get in good trouble, necessary trouble. We're going to continue our struggle for civil disobedience. We're going back to City Hall. We will demonstrate and disrupt meetings, and we may even do pop-up protests at various businesses in this area. It's time for you guys to address this issue that includes Mark Lamping and Shad Khan at the Jaguars. It's time for you guys to stand up against racial injustice.
Thank you both for being with us. We'll continue to follow it. Ben Frazier, Northside Coalition of Jacksonville. Wells Todd of Take 'em Down Jacks. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Melissa.
And much more still ahead later. How you can be part of Welcoming Week in Jacksonville. We'll tell you all about it, but up next.
The thing about going after abortion, about having a big to-do about the most controversial aspect of women's health care, is the preventative and safety features of health care go with it.
A retired nurse remembers this nation's first abortion trial after the passage of Roe v. Wade. That's after this. Well, local retired nurse Mary Marcus was in the courtroom when this nation's first abortion trial took place after the passage of Roe v. Wade. In 1975, a Boston physician named Dr. Kenneth Edelin was convicted of manslaughter for performing a legal abortion. Now, that conviction was later overturned on appeal. It was a landmark test of medical, legal, religious, and political questions surrounding abortion in America. Well, these discussions are back once again in full force after a law passed in Texas basically banning abortion. And Mary has thoughts on a potential new Florida law that would pattern itself after the Texas statute. I spoke with her, and here's that conversation.
So, Mary, take us back to the 1970s when you were at the trial of the first real challenge to Roe v. Wade.
It was 1975. I had been volunteering a charitable organization and heard that there was a trial in Boston. And so I was curious about it and went. The vibe in the courtroom was really intense. Strangely enough, I happened to go on a day that the delivery room nurse was testifying. At that time, you actually stood up in front of the courtroom and did it. So she had to walk through the whole courtroom and then stand up and give her testimony. And basically what they were asking her was whether there had been a clock in the delivery room. A lot of the testimony was based on the fact that the doctor in question had held the baby's head up against the womb to smother it and looked at the clock to time it to make sure that the baby wasn't breathing when the doctor delivered it. This wasn't true, but that's what they were alleging.
So this trial, a couple of years after the passage of the law, this doctor was put on trial for manslaughter, for performing a legal abortion. That's the backstory to this. What are your thoughts in the wake of the law that's now passed in Texas and the way that this has become a front burner issue once again for so many Americans, given that you were there at the time when the law became the law of the land, and then you saw the legal challenges shortly thereafter?
Well, when I had gone to the trial, I was the same age. I was in my 20s. So I actually could have been somebody who had an abortion as well as being a nurse. Now I'm in my 70s. And what's fascinating to me, what goes through my head, is some of the language that was used during Dr. Edelin's trial, the heartbeat and so on, of the fetus as being judge of whether sustaining life. A lot of that verbiage comes from that time.
Women who were present in the days before Roe v. Wade in hospital settings have talked a lot about this. Can you talk about what it was like when abortion wasn't legal and women would seek out illegal means to end their pregnancies?
The infections and the bleeding, the uterus is very vascular. And if the abortion isn't done correctly, there's birth products still left in the womb, which means they can bleed pretty freely. And when they would come in, and the young women were usually alone, there was usually nobody with them, they would say they had abdominal pain. So until you brought them back, you didn't even know that they had had an abortion. It was only on exam that they finally would admit that they had had an abortion. Some young women just died. Some had overwhelming infections that you just can't believe. All because they were embarrassed and ashamed. And if you think about the fact that we didn't have adequate birth control, it was pretty bad in a college town like Boston.
So what are your thoughts then about the Texas law and also the possibility of a similar law being proposed in Florida?
It would be terrible. It would be just because the thing about going after abortion, about having a big to-do about the most controversial aspect of women's health care is the preventative and safety features of health care go with it. If you think about it, Planned Parenthood does so much more than help with abortion. They do exams and breast exams and counseling and birth control and all of that. When you shut down one part of the service in a big way, you have crowds going against it, you take away funding, you make it a big deal, the other services go with it. So that's a problem. The other problem no one's discussing is if you carry the baby to term because you don't have access to abortion, what do you do for prenatal care? And what do you do for postpartum care? And how do you prevent birth defects if women without money cannot have access to care because a clinic is shut down because of abortions? So it's a string that when you pull, the whole thing unravels. And if we go back to that time, it could conceivably even be worse.
Well, this is Welcoming Week, a time set aside to celebrate the contributions of immigrants. To mark the occasion, the First Coast YMCA is joining Welcoming America alongside other Ys around the country to celebrate immigrants in this community. Amber Dodge is Senior Program Director of the First Coast Y New American Welcome Center. She's on the line. Hi, Amber.
Hi, Melissa. How are you doing today?
I'm great, thanks. It's good to talk to you and learn a little bit about Welcoming Week. Tell us what the Y is doing.
Yes, ma'am. So every year we partner with Welcoming America, which is a national organization that promotes Welcoming Weeks annually. It's in September, and this year it's September 10th through the 19th. And this year we will be hosting an event at the Winston Family YMCA where we will have free international food tasting from different local immigrant-owned businesses, and also some music and just basically a time where families come together from different backgrounds to meet their new neighbors that are new to Jacksonville, as well as meet neighbors that have been here longer, and to promote healthy communities and cross-cultural interaction.
This international food tasting Saturday at the Winston Family YMCA, by the way, I'm a member of the Winston Family Y, so I am definitely going to be stopping by Saturday between noon and 2. I'm looking here at the menu. You're going to have Ethiopian food, Thai food, Afghani food. That's interesting given that some more Afghan refugees have been coming to town very recently. Venezuelan food. So food from around the world, from local restaurant owners and local immigrants. You know, Amber, people might not realize how truly diverse Jacksonville is and how we have people from all over the world.
It really is. And that's basically really the goal of this event on Saturday, and really what Welcoming Week is just to engage people, to educate our community about the diversity in our city. And that's why we're featuring restaurants that maybe, you know, Jacksonville residents have not tried, maybe Afghani food. Or where we will have Burmese food from a Thai restaurant, but the owners are from Burma. So, you know, in order for people to try new foods, and then I believe that food really breaks barriers, people coming together to share a meal. So once they try this, you know, different types of food and then meet families from those countries that will be at the event, I mean, that starts relationships. That can start breaking barriers, building cross-cultural relationships. So we really targeted restaurants that people may not have tried before because they're in small pockets in our city where they're located.
Yeah. And in particular, just in recent weeks, resettlement agencies like Lutheran Social Services and Catholic Charities have been bringing Afghan families to this city, families fleeing the Taliban after the Taliban took over their country. So this is really topical, Amber. People have the opportunity to meet new immigrants who have come here simply to build a better life and particularly to bring safety for their children and prosperity for their children.
Yes, and I mean, this is a great opportunity to meet Afghani families. We will have some at the event that are a part of our New American Welcome Center, which is at the DuPont Family Y. So we are a program of the First Coast YMCA. But definitely, it's a great opportunity to meet these new families, to talk to them, to welcome them. That's what Welcoming Week is about, to say, welcome to Jacksonville. We're happy you're here. We're happy that your family is safe. And then, you know, they contribute so much to our society, either food or through their employment or through their children, you know, going to school and just building friendships with new people. So we are happy they're here. We're happy to be able to support them in some way and welcome them. And that's why we're thankful for the First Coast YMCA and for the Winston Y, because of its location, on the St. John's River. It's outdoors. And so just a chance to have fun in a safe way to meet new neighbors. Now, that's what Welcoming Week is about.
What it's all about. Now, Amber, in addition to the delicious food Saturday at the Winston Y, you're also having there's a 10-day celebration with free virtual events as well. Can you share a little bit about what's happening there and how people can learn more about all of this?
Yes, so we do have a Facebook page, the First Coast YMCA New American Welcome Center, but also, you know, internationally, the YMCA is hosting online events through Zoom. Monday, they just had one, you know, just to kick off Welcoming Week. There's another one, I believe, tomorrow about how you can get involved with Afghani families nationally, because Welcoming Week is throughout the nation. So there's online events. You can search from First Coast YMCA's Facebook page or, the YMCA nationally by connecting with social media. But that's the best way. Because of COVID and because of just safety precautions, a lot of things are online. But we did want to have an event in person, outdoors, so people can really interact in a safe way.
Right. Now, yeah, I have to confess, I've sort of been avoiding the Y.
Yes.
Partly because I'm lazy and partly because of COVID. I keep telling myself, you know, I got to get back in the gym. I got to get back in the gym. And this is a good opportunity for me to do that. Although it's kind of hard to work out with a mask on. It's kind of hard to run on the treadmill with your mask on. That's why I've been blowing it off. But with all of that said, will the food tasting be outside? How is this going to be staged?
Yes. So it's going to be outside in the like playground area, you know, closer to the riverside of Winston where the river is located. So it will be outdoors. Everything will be outdoors. We will have stations for children, some different activities spread out for kids, a craft area. There's a playground. And the food will be placed in the boxes that people can take with them. Or they can sit in the grass area by Winston Y and sit and enjoy with their family along our beautiful river. So it is safe. It's outdoors. Nothing will be inside. I believe that Winston Y will also be giving free tours just so people can learn more about the Winston YMCA and the services the First Coast YMCA provides to our city. So it's definitely a safe environment. Everything will be outdoors.
And free, right? This is like a free food festival. Everything's free, folks. So don't miss it. Mark your calendar for Saturday noon on the St. John's River outside the Winston Family YMCA on Riverside Avenue. A free international food tasting event. Taste your way through the delicious restaurants of Jacksonville as part of Welcoming Week. And check out the First Coast YMCA's New American Welcome Center at the DuPont Family Y Youth Development Campus at Old Kings Road. And Amber Dodge, Senior Program Director of that center, with us. This is great stuff, Amber, and I look forward to seeing you there. And I think I'm going to work out and then go reward myself with some delicious food at noon.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Yeah, I hope to see people come out and meet new families to Jacksonville. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. See you there on Saturday. Now, speaking of food, everybody, a quick break, but in a moment, we'll tell you how you can support Feeding Northeast Florida because it is Hunger Action Month and how you can help the thousands of food insecure families right here in our area. That's coming up in just a few minutes. We'll be right back. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. Don't go away.
WJCT Public Media is bringing you a new healthcare show, What's Health Got to Do with It? Our goal is to help you navigate all things health and healthcare and get you the answers you deserve. Join me, Dr. Joe Servin, Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 9 p.m. on WJCT News 89.9, sponsored in part by American Brain Foundation, Epilepsy Foundation, and Norellis.
Ascension St. Vincent's. CARE is listening and delivering personalized plans from a team of specialists dedicated to providing the latest technology and treatment at every step. Information and appointments at getjackshealthcare.com. St. John's County Cultural Events Division presents Sing Out Loud Festival in St. Augustine, September 10th through 26th. Over 100 performances, including TLC, Parquet Courts, YOLA, Patty Griffin, and May Day Parade. Info at singoutloudfestival.com. Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
WJCT Public Media and the Florida Theater presents Spirogyra, performing live at the WJCT Soundstage on Thursday, September 30th, 2021 at 7:30 p.m. Visit jacksmusic.org/events for tickets.
On the next Fresh Air, the fight to keep independent journalism alive in small-town America. We speak with Art Cullen, who runs a newspaper in Storm Lake, Iowa, along with his brother, wife, and son. Cullen, who won a Pulitzer Prize for taking on local agribusiness interests, is featured in the new documentary, Storm Lake. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Across the country, school board meetings are getting out of control.
You're going to cause me and a lot of these other people that can afford to homeschool our kids to withdraw our kids from your school system.
Parents and activists are organizing to make sure they win elections to school boards next year. A look at what's behind the shouting matches and the moves to shake up our schools next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, nearly 240,000 people in our area are what's known as food insecure, and that's about 76,000 children. What it means is one in five people in our food bank's eight-county service area are going hungry. Last year, the need for food assistance in North Florida skyrocketed 129%. And many of these, nearly half of the people that were served early in the pandemic especially, had never asked for help before. Now, September is Hunger Action Month, and tomorrow is Hunger Action Day. There's a lot you can do to help fight hunger on the First Coast. It's easy to help out. For more, I spoke with Susan King, President and CEO of Feeding Northeast Florida.
Susan, good to talk to you. So recently, Feeding Northeast Florida took part in a roundtable in partnership with the White House COVID response team. You had the opportunity to talk about food insecurity in our area and the effects of the pandemic. Tell us about that.
Well, hello, Melissa. It's great. It's great to be with you today. Yeah, it was a really interesting and I think fruitful discussion. A lot of community members from various vantage points, really discussing the reality of what we are all seeing on the ground. I thought we came away with some great shared ideas and a really a good discussion.
And of course, it's a vital discussion to be having, particularly since this is Hunger Action Month, where people all over the country stand together against hunger. This is a year-round problem here on the First Coast. 240,000 people food insecure in our area, and a lot of kids too, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. The current estimates of approximately 237,000 individuals in Northeast Florida are facing food insecurity. Of that, that's one in seven adults and one in five children. It's a shocking and horrifying number when you think about a child going to bed without dinner, not necessarily knowing where the next meal is coming from. But Hunger Action Month is an important time for us to really shine a light and focus the country's attention and certainly our community's attention on these very difficult decisions that families make every day. It is an impossible choice, kind of the theme of this year's discussion. The idea that a parent will be feeding their children and not have enough to feed themselves, that they'll be making decisions between food and medicine or paying their light bill. You know, it's for those of us who live a really blessed life, you think, gosh, I don't know how people make those decisions, but they do every day. So Hunger Action Month is a time for us to really, you know, take a stand, create awareness of hunger in our community and truly inspire individuals to get involved with the effort to fight it.
Now, you're doing a lot this month, including partnering up with the Jaguars Foundation, some food distributions. You're even lighting up the city orange. Is that right? What's the significance of the orange?
Well, orange is been Feeding America's color of hunger. It's just that
color that we always associate. It's, you see it in all of our branding for all of 200 Feeding America food banks. And so we have a wonderful group of partners who have agreed to light up orange. I believe this week Florida Blues Riverside campus is alight with orange, and the Costa Bridge and the Laura Street Bridge, kind of all during the month. We've got different partners that are have agreed to light up orange. I believe the Jags Stadium is going, and Daly's Place will be this Friday night, will be lit up orange. So yeah, very, very exciting time. We've done over, or we'll be doing 30 specific mobile pantries geared at families and children, and just to focus on this issue of hunger. We did one, in fact, today with the Jaguar Foundation, and had a huge turnout. Couple of alumni players and Jackson DeVille, and really just created an event to highlight Hunger Action Month. We've also been hosting Hunger Action Month volunteer days each Saturday during the month of September, specifically kind of preparing for the holidays that'll be ahead of us in the next couple of months, and really inviting new volunteers into our warehouse, and that's been great. If anybody's interested, it's an easy sign-up form on our website. Mayor Lenny Curry has proclaimed September as Hunger Action Month in Jacksonville. We got a beautiful proclamation from the city a few days ago, really reinforcing the importance of this effort.
Great to see that. Friday, September 17th, wear orange to mark Hunger Action Day, and volunteer, pledge to advocate, or donate this month. Just go to their website, feedingnefl.org. Do your part to fight hunger on the First Coast. The demand is through the roof for help in this pandemic. Susan King, President, CEO of Feeding Northeast Florida, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks also to Heather Schatz and Catherine Hobbs, both out for Yom Kippur today. We look forward to seeing them again tomorrow. Josh Torres, our director, always keeps this plane flying. And our editorial director is Jessica Palumbo. Keep the emails coming. We like your feedback. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day. Be safe.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.